You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. As we've done with our last couple of podcasts, taping this in Toronto, where my family and I remain in self-quarantine after coming back from the United States. Like when we did Dr. Celine Gounder and Grant Wall, I have a coronavirus-related guest as well, and I think somebody you're going to find really interesting. Chico Harlan is the Rome Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. He joined that paper in 2008, where he started off doing, of all things, covering the Washington Nationals. We'll talk a little bit about that. He then spent 4 years as the paper's East Asia Bureau Chief, focusing on Japan and the Korean Peninsula. He has been in Rome since June of 2018. And that is where we talk to Chico Harlan today. Chico, thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you, Richard.
All right, Chico. There's a number of things I want to get to. But first and foremost, just how are you? You're in Rome. You're in the middle of a country that has been sort of the center of this pandemic. How are you? What is your health at the moment? And what is your day-to-day, if you can give us a sense of it?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for asking. I surely, you know, have nothing to complain about in terms of my own health next to anybody else. I mean, I'm not sick. I've been working quite hard, and that has brought, you know, some stresses as well as some adrenaline. And it has been good to have a sense that I'm doing something important. And the work feels almost like the only part of my life that is semi-normal. Like I know how to cover a big story and really be dedicated, you know, 16 hours a day to something. This maybe is a little bit longer than other peaks, but at least like writing the stories, you know, this is the only part of my day-to-day that hasn't flipped upside down. The hard part has been simply being cooped up and seeing the country or my city really, really atomize and be a place that, you know, in the most literal way feels like it has been like dehumanized. There's nobody around anymore and not for any reason other than just an epic tragedy. So for a while, you know, there were stresses even with my own family, like should my wife and baby go back? This was a few weeks ago before there was a lockdown. We were trying to, you know, like so many other people, compute whether other places might be safer for them, whether they could get better help from my wife's parents, which, you know, because I've been working hard, they've kind of been on their own. Anyway, we decided to stick together and to avoid what could be a long-term separation given the way countries are kind of raising their borders right now. And so it's really been the three of us inside of this apartment for the last couple of weeks. I've been really, you know, working most hours of the day, but by phone. And it's been a surreal existence inside of this apartment trying to document the crazy things that are happening in Italy.
Chico, can you give us a sense of just like where you are in the city? For people, probably there'll be people listening who have never been to Italy, let alone Rome, but just sort of geographically give us a little bit of a sense of where you are and perhaps even in relation to the worst places in the country right now.
Sure. Okay. So in terms of Rome, I am in the city center, a little bit close to the river. Maybe the best landmark would be Campo di Fiori, which is under normal times, kind of a gross touristy market. And now there is nobody there. The hardest hit parts of Italy are to the north, in the area of Lombardy, which includes Milan. And I can't give you like a kilometer estimate, but by bullet train, it's about 3.5 hours. And so Italy is small enough that that the things that happened there surely have been internalized here. And though Rome hasn't been as hard hit, it has more than 1,000 confirmed cases. And the behavior is as if it has 100,000, because when you do go outside, you see people who are suspicious of everybody. They're all wearing masks. If they're going to the grocery store, they're wearing surgical gloves. And I think for a lot of cities, the behavioral changes don't come until the horror has kind of arrived. And I keep kind of telling myself, maybe wishfully, but that Rome is perhaps a little safer than other major cities of the world, because it's one of the few places where people change their behavior before the crisis hit true emergency level.
Chico, what are the challenges of reporting the story right now for you?
There are a couple. Number one is truly just staring the horror of this in the face every day. There have been some times when it is hard to wake up knowing that you're going to be on the phone with doctors, or even just on Twitter looking at videos from these hospitals and thinking about it, because you're basically writing about death, and you're writing about people who aren't getting care, and you're writing about a sort of loneliness that comes on families that are losing people because funerals aren't allowed, because if someone goes to the hospital with the virus and dies, they are not having contact with anybody. They're being buried by a priest and by a funeral director, and their families are under quarantine. It is really a kind of extraordinary suffering, and it's so widespread. And so my job is to be in that world remotely, but still be there. And that part, though it feels really vital, I wouldn't say that it's easy, and it's not comparable to what I normally do journalism-wise. And then the logistical side is the second part, which, just because for a combination of reasons, the government restrictions on movement, the fact that I want to be in writing about different places from one day to the next, the fact that I'm worried about my own family's safety, I haven't been moving around really much at all. I haven't traveled outside of Rome, and phone interviews are not as good as being on the ground. And for now, that is what I've been trying to do to get by. But the sort of value for being on the ground, you know, if you're in a place for a few days now, that's not a 3-day trip. That's a 17-day trip, because you have to add in the quarantine. And then all of a sudden, if something else happens in another place, you can't be there. So I think for journalists everywhere, they're trying to figure out, how do you cover this, and what is worth the risk? And you know, I haven't seen much on the ground journalism in Italy. And I've noticed that it's kind of dried up a little bit in the United States too. Like in the first couple of weeks, there were stories from these nursing homes, like in Washington. Now it's being done largely over the phone. And a few days ago, I did see this Sky TV report, which I would encourage people, if their stomachs are steeled, to watch it from inside of one of these hospitals in Bergamo, which is really hard hit. And it just like wrecked me for the day, because first, because of the images, and second, because I was thinking, should I be doing that? Is that essential to be doing? And I don't know. We don't even know that much about this virus yet, and so calculating the risk becomes really difficult. Generally, my instinct is to wait and try to get more information, and to learn more about the virus before I take anything that feels risky, not just for myself, but more importantly, you know, I'd be bringing home the risk to my family. And so it does feel like an unprecedented time for journalists, because not just those in Italy, but all over the world are going to eventually be covering this thing. And guidelines are nice to have, but they're always changing at this point.
One of the, as well said, one of the, you know, you talked about sort of things that are gutting, and one of the things that, you know, if you're reading the news and sort of trying to find accurate and informed sources, one of the things that really struck with me was seeing the obituaries in Italian papers. Obviously, I don't speak Italian. I don't read Italian, but you don't sort of need to speak the language or read the language to understand, like, some of those videos of some of the bigger papers in Italy, and just pages and pages of obits. I mean, it was man, it was hard to see. So I understand. I asked this question understanding that everything that you're covering is troubling and awful. But at this point, what whether it's a singular story or something else, what has really been the thing that sort of troubled you the most, or the most concerning thing that you've covered, let's say, over the last 2 weeks in Rome?
Well, from a purely emotional standpoint, I guess it is the convergence of like loneliness that comes upon the dead in these areas that are hard hit. Say your father or any, you know, just anybody's father becomes sick with this and gets taken to a hospital, then they die a few weeks later. You're not able to have in Italy any contact with them as they deteriorate in this hospital, and then afterwards you're not able to be there for a funeral. That's so incredibly lonely, and it goes against, you know, what societies have become accustomed to over millennia, this process of grief, and it's all been upended. So that part is like it really shows how beyond the death toll for each person who's dying, there's this profound sadness that is left with the families that I don't think is something that people can easily process. So that's been really tough. And you mentioned these obituaries. Yeah, this is in a town. It's not even a major city. It's Bergamo, which has about 100,000 people. And normally their obituaries are 2 or 3 pages long. They've been now 10, 11, 12 pages in this town, which, I mean, it's a miracle they're even putting out this newspaper on a day-to-day basis, because this town has really been brought to its knees by the virus. But this is also the place where it was that hospital that I was referencing. And I guess in terms of the other things that have stuck with me, it's the images of people one after the next on gurneys, like even in the hallways of hospitals, because there's no other space for them. They can't breathe. And some of the most, the worst off patients are on their back, intubated, basically attached to very heavy duty breathing machines. But other ones who are a little bit better off, not as critical, have these, I would describe them almost like plastic helmets on. So their heads are totally encased, and they look almost like Lego men with these oversized heads because of the devices that they have on. And they're all just taking such methodical, labored breaths, one after the next, sardine together. And some are young. Not all, most aren't, but you definitely see some people in there in their 50s, 40s, and you wonder what happened, you know, why them? I mean, there's no answer. There's not always an answer with this stuff.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Chico, you know, I saw one of the things that's pretty alarming now, obviously, in hindsight, is I saw a lot of these videos of some famous places in Rome, you know, Spanish Steps, et cetera, where a couple weeks ago people were out and tourists were there and people were doing what they normally do in Rome and in Italy. Can you give me a sense of, because I think it's a valuable lesson for Americans, obviously, like, what was it like? Like, when did this change in Italy? Like, when did the behavior like dramatically shift? And for how long did people not take any kind of warning seriously?
I think that in Italy, people were a little bit slow to understand the gravity of this, but in an understandable way. When the first couple hundred or even first couple thousand cases were coming, the message from some politicians was, okay, you know, This is something that is a manageable risk, and we should still be socializing with the proper protocols in place for a while. Italy kept restaurants, even in the north, open for limited hours, and the rules were simply to try to limit overcrowding. And it was about 2 weeks ago that, as you know, the number of dead just kept rising by the day, the number of cases was going up astronomically, that the government took far more drastic steps. First, they locked down the north of the country, 16 million people. That was probably 16 days ago at this point. And then 2 days later, they applied it to the whole country. And I think in this case, the government was maybe a few steps behind the science and surely behind the virus, but they were probably ahead of the people, because Romans were still mostly carrying on as normal. And the first day of the lockdown, the city was maybe even appreciating the quiet a little bit. People were still moving around. 2, 3, 4, things started changing, darkening for sure. And the restrictions have been incrementally tightened. So no restaurants are not open now. Nothing is open other than the bare minimum, supermarkets, pharmacies. You're not even allowed to go outside jogging or running. So it's not like, oh, here are the Spanish Steps. There's no tourists around. Let's go walk with the baby in the stroller. No, you cannot leave the house. You're not allowed to go outside for any reason other than an essential. And you need to have a certification that is getting ever more bureaucratic by the day that you're supposed to print out and have with you if you're going outside. So maybe I can be proven wrong. Maybe this can become more absolute than it already is. There are people that are getting arrested or charged for breaking the protocol, but by and large, Italians are really going with this, I think, in a way that is admirable. And that's been 2 weeks now. So imagine 2 weeks of real strict adherence to a lockdown that the U.S. is nowhere close to getting to. And only now, after 12 days of this, is there even the first glimmer that it might be working. Like, the explosion of death and cases is baked in before you take any action. So even if the U.S. tomorrow was to put everybody in their house, nothing would change about the scale of this outbreak until the end of March or even into the beginning of April. So, like, the bomb is lit before you even are aware of it. And that's part of what makes this virus scary.
Chico, I presume that obviously you're fluent in Italian and you can read the papers and watch local news. Can you give listeners just a sense of what is it like for the Italian media? What are you seeing every day on television? What are you reading every day in the papers?
Well, I'm not fluent in Italian. I've been trying to study, and my comprehension is way better than my speaking. But reading the papers, surely I'm doing that every single day. I think the Italian media is doing its best. They're documenting every little flare up with real granular precision, and I guess if you were to only read the Italian papers, you might miss the scale of the global pandemic, but you would get a sense of the suffering in Italy. I normally the Italian papers are kind of a sounding board for the political back and forth, and it can kind of get very inside baseball, but that's been mostly put aside during this. And they do come up, because they have journalists all over the country, of course, they come up with inside views of places that it would be hard for a single foreign correspondent to get to. So it's invaluable to see it. For me, I'm kind of, the audience that I have in mind is a little different than them, because I'm always thinking about Americans and people in other countries. And the way I kind of am thinking about it is what are the things that are happening, unfolding in Italy, that can kind of provide a warning sign for other countries, or might light the road. And maybe 3 weeks ago, I was thinking there could be some preemptive steps that they take by looking at the Italian disaster. But now I think it's more that Italy is just a pretty grim preview of what's to come in other places.
It's foreboding. What is your process in terms of... And describe this as literal as you want, but how ultimately are you filing your stories? what's the process of you and post editors, either back in Washington or elsewhere? I'm going to sort of ask you a couple of questions just so you can go freeform. And then are stories assigned to you, or are you pretty much independent in terms of you could ultimately decide what story gets done that day?
Yeah, I'm mostly coming up with my own ideas, and it's a mix of just the news, the important stuff of the day, but also trying to make sure that in any given week I can have two or three pieces that really feel more like stories. They might be explanatory. They might try to just tap into a place or a moment or an emotion. But I've been, you know, this is a moment when Italy couldn't have more stories that you want to tell. But I've been trying to narrow that down by thinking about what are the things that are only happening in Italy because it is at the leading edge of the outbreak. And so, for instance, like, I wouldn't necessarily want to write about precautions being taken at nursing homes because that's happening everywhere. I'd be looking for the kinds of stories that are only for now happening in Italy and might soon be happening elsewhere. And that all goes back to having this more American audience in mind.
Chico, I realize this is a pretty big question, but what can Americans learn, even at this late date, from what's happened in Italy?
Well, I just would hope that people can perform the mental trick of being scared before the disaster is right in front of their face. Like, you do see these PSAs from celebrities sort of saying stay indoors as if it's like a good community thing to be doing. But even that doesn't quite feel right to me, because to really understand the gravity of what's happening, you almost have to try to play forward the way that this virus grows in magnitude by the day. And so you're taking action based not on what your world looks like right now, but what it could look like in a week or 2 weeks. So it's not like you have to use your imagination. You can look at Italy and you can decide, okay, I'm going to start today pretending like I have this virus, or pretending like everybody around me other than my nuclear family might have this virus. That sounds like a terrible way to live. And it is. It's a totally terrible way to live. But it's the only way to fully internalize the mindset that is necessary to social distance in the way you need to for this virus to be minimized. And, you know, the unknown is how long that would be necessary. Ideally, there's some cocktail of medicines or longer down the road, a vaccine. Maybe the warmer weather helps. There's some reason to think that might be the case. But for now, for March, for April, you know, it would be better to find a mental trick that helps you get really scared of this before it comes to your own neighborhood. And if the social distancing works and the disaster never escalates, maybe you look back on it and say, oh, that was all for nothing. That would be great that you could thank Italy for that.
Are Italian officials telling the public anything about time frames in terms of how long they expect you know, the state of emergencies throughout the country to continue? Because as you know, one of the sort of things as we're talking now, one of the talking points in the United States, rather scarily, is the possibility of of people going back to work and a shortened social isolation or social distancing plan in the U.S. Again, just for listeners who might not be aware of this, what are Italian officials telling citizens right now in terms of this stuff?
Well, they're due to update, because as of now, the restrictions are supposed to end on April 3rd. Obviously, that's not going to happen. They'll be extended. I don't know how long. In terms of messaging to the citizens, it is not yet clear. But the Prime Minister has said in an interview with one of the Italian papers a few days ago that April 3rd will not be the end date for this stuff. Nobody really knows, but this is another area where Italy does get to kind of be, along with China to an extent, the guinea pigs for how to release the levers gradually. You know, right now China is trying to slowly get back to normal, and that's another moment when countries can really be at risk. But China can also has means to control people and to surveil that Italy and other democracies don't. So Italy will be facing its own challenges when it gets to that point, but it's nowhere near that yet. I mean, this is, you can't really get to that point until the number of cases is down dramatically and until the hospitals have had a time to recover and to get back to normal, to the point where they can handle other things. Right now they can't. Right now the Italian healthcare system in the north is barely able to breathe. Like one of the doctors I was talking to yesterday said basically the system is like an animal on a rock in the middle of the ocean with only its nose above the water, as if to say, like, you know, one more degree higher and the whole thing goes down. And in some parts of Italy, in some cities, it's already gone down. So, you know, things have to get a whole lot better before you can relax.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because you've really had an interesting career, you've done what you've done at The Post. Prior to that, you worked out of Pittsburgh. But, you know, for the purposes of this podcast, which is sort of at its core a sports media podcast, you once covered the Nationals. And I wonder if, you know, and I wonder if as you're sort of, you know, in 2020, you're covering this pandemic, this global crisis in Rome, you ever sort of just sort of think about your days as covering the Nationals baseball, sort of like it must be surreal for you. In once upon a time, you were sort of just a baseball writer, like many colleagues and people that I know. And then sort of fast forward, you know, whatever, 12 years later, you're covering this. Life must have seemed a lot easier when you're, you know, only sort of thinking about Steven Strasburg and some of that other stuff.
Right. Well, I mean, it's no more surreal to think back on 12 years ago doing that than it is to look back on 2 months ago, just living my life here. They both feel like a lifetime ago. But covering sports, and you know, I think you've talked to other sports writers at the Post who've changed. Like Chelsea Janes was one of my successors on the beat, and she's covering the campaign now. The Post has been a place where you can kind of jump from one topic to the other, and I think it's healthy, because you know, basically the muscles of doing journalism are not that different from topic to topic, but surely when you're covering sports, especially baseball, you're writing a lot of stories quickly, and in a pandemic that actually it helps. Like most of the stuff I'm doing now is not on deadline, but I remember when I was in just really a year or two out of the baseball beat, in 2011, it must have been, Kim Jong-il died. And he died like 30 minutes before our newspaper's deadline. And I had that much time, or his death was announced, to put that more accurately. And I had 30 minutes to put a story together. And it worked. It worked totally well. I did not sweat it, because I'd done that exact thing so many times, hundreds of times during the previous few years. And I thought, you know, this, all these game stories at Nats Park at 12:30 a.m. definitely led to that. And still, those muscles haven't completely gone away, which I'm thankful for. And you know, as a non-sports writer now, looking back, it's actually easier to like sports now, because I'm not in the locker room. I'm really just a fan now. So I was watching the Nats getting up in the middle of the night during their World Series run, and now they'll probably be defending champs until 2021.
Very true. Who is your favorite person in baseball to cover as a subject?
As a subject? Oh, wow. Of course, you know, these answers are always lame, because the best people to talk to are always the ones who are scrubs, who are forgotten, who are one step away from like AAA. Those are the ones that always had the time for me. So I'm trying to think. I don't have a favorite, but the teams that I covered were terrible, were totally dreadful. I think one of the teams 102 games and another had lost 103. This is the reason they got Harper and Strasburg are in the opposite order in back-to-back years, because they were the worst team in baseball 2 years in a row. So I must have watched 60 people throw their last pitch or take their last swing in a uniform, because several of those players ended up following me to Japan and Korea.
Yeah, that's I'm looking right now on the 2008 Washington Nationals. Man, I forgot how horrible they were. 59-102. Manny Acta was the manager. Wow, Jim Bowden, now of the Athletic, was the general manager. I mean, Chico, this was a horrible team. I mean, these guys, this is a bad year. Aaron Boone, now the Yankees manager, was the first baseman on that team. Wow, I forgot about this team. That's crazy.
Aaron Boone was a pretty good guy. He was, you know, most of these guys were nice and would give you the time, and they were lovely in spring training. But then by April 23rd, you know, they're 3-18, their season is over, and everybody knows it. And you just have to play out the string, and you're there writing and documenting the next 130 games, 100 of which are going to be losses. And by the end of the season, it's just a really nasty, nasty environment.
By the way, Tim Redding is the ace of the staff. That really tells you everything you need to know right there.
Tim Redding ended up playing in the Korean Professional League.
Jeez. Yeah, wow. Well, there you go. Listen, Chico, I wish you, obviously, you and your family, nothing but the best of health. You're doing incredibly important work in very, very stressful times, and a lot of people appreciate it. Even if you're isolated there, trust me, I'm reading. There's a lot of people who are reading. Chico Harlan is the Rome Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. He joined that paper in 2008, and as I just cited before, he was a Washington Nationals beat writer. He then spent 4 years at the paper's East Asia Bureau Chief, focusing on Japan and the Korean Peninsula. Prior to that, he worked in Pittsburgh, and I think maybe even in Sydney for a little bit. So he's had a really, really interesting career. Check out his work at the Post, because I really think it's sort of a precursor of what is coming and what is here now in the United States. And if you're on Twitter and you want to follow Chico on Twitter, it's at Chico Harlan. So at @ChicoHarlan. Chico, man, it's really good of you to do this. I'll be certainly staying in touch with you over the interwebs. And yeah, my best to you and your family. Stay safe, man. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Okay, thanks, Richard.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Chico Harlan for talking to us from Rome. I hope you found that interesting. I did. A little scary too. Previous guest on this podcast, Scott Van Pelt, was the last guest I did, and that was sort of doing SportsCenter in the age of a pandemic. Before that, Dr. Celine Gounder and Grant Wall. They are married. Celine Gounder is a foremost epidemiologist in this country. Grant Wall, her husband, one of the foremost soccer writers in this country. Before that, a couple podcasts with John Olrand about Tony Romo's mega contract and some other stuff going on in the sports media. And then just head to our archives page, where you can find all the podcasts we've done. Please leave us a 5-star review if you like this stuff. That's how the podcast continues. Great thanks to Sean Cherry and Patrick Antonetti for putting this podcast together, especially with somebody from Italy. Thanks and good wishes, staying safe, to everybody at Cadence 13, from Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, John McDermott, and the guys I mentioned. This is Richard Deitch, and we'll continue to put out the podcast as long as we can. We'll see you next week on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.